It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
It's Laurie and John. It's always Laurie and John.
Good morning. It's John and Laurie. Good morning, Evie. Happy Fourth of July.
Independence Day.
Happy Fourth. Independence.
Happy Fourth of July.
You can get in the middle. Oh, you're in New York. You're safe.
That's right. Thank God.
And we have so much as a country, as a nation, to be grateful for. We have so many thanks that we should each of us give to those in service to keep our freedoms protected, to keep us safe, and as our forefathers did over two centuries ago. So happy 4th of July and many multiple thanks and warm-hearted greetings to all of our soldiers, both as here and abroad. But I would like to open by reading an article that I just finished, which I'll send to you, Hezzy, as soon as we're finished with our segment, to post on the Yonkers Tribune. I'm going to read what I wrote, and listeners, you can read it on the Yonkers Tribune website. But about a great American who died 2 days ago, and I'm talking about none other than Lee Iacocca.
Yeah.
And so let me read, and I hope this is a good enough tribute for a very great American who made his mark on our country.
Mm.
On July 2nd, 2019, America lost arguably the best-known pitchman in the automotive business and Detroit's most powerful, ingenious executive. Lee Iacocca was the only executive to head two of Detroit's three top automotive manufacturers. Best known for developing the Ford Mustang and Pinto in the 1960s and for reviving Chrysler in the 1980s, the story of this Depression-era kid born of Italian immigrants is one of our nation's great success stories. Born in Allentown, Pennsylvania in 1924, Lee Anthony Iacocca was the son of Nicola Iacocca and Antoinetta Perota, who owned and operated Yoko's Hot Dogs in Allentown.
Mm.
He graduated from Lehigh University with a degree in industrial engineering and won the Wallace Memorial Fellowship, which allowed him to attend Princeton University. From there, he launched his lifetime career in the automotive industry, getting his first job at Ford in 1946 as an engineer. He was 22. Shortly after he was hired, he asked to be moved from engineering to sales and marketing. A real people person, the change would serve him well throughout his career. He devised and launched Ford's 1956 campaign, 20% down, $56 a month for 3 years. The concept caught on like wildfire, and Lee was plucked up and elevated to Ford's headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan. In November 1960, he was named vice president and general manager of Ford, and in 1965 promoted to vice president of Ford's car and truck group. In 1967, he became executive vice president and, in 1970, president of Ford Motor Company. He was instrumental in the design of the Ford Mustang, the Continental Mark III, the Ford Escort, and the revival of the Mercury brand in the 1960s, introducing the Mercury Cougar and Mercury Marquis. He saw the need for an American-made, small, fuel-efficient, lightweight car for under $2,000 and assembled Ford's team of designers to produce the Ford Pinto, which came out in 1971. This change in direction from large gas-guzzling cars changed the course of the industry. Lee would take with him concepts he tried but failed to introduce at Ford when, in 1978, he was fired in a fit of rage by Henry Ford II, despite the fact that Ford posted a $2 billion profit that very same year, and he took over the helm at Chrysler. That concept were the, became the highly successful K cars and Chrysler minivans. Chrysler was in bad shape when Iacocca came on board. The auto manufacturer was on the verge of going out of business, despite having been forced to sell its European division to Peugeot. Complications resulting from recalls of the Dodge Aspen and Plymouth Volare, cars that Iacocca maintained should never have been built, further weighed down the financial buoyancy of the drowning company. Lee's first success at Chrysler was launching the Minimax project Ford II had quashed, introducing the highly successful Dodge Caravan and Plymouth Voyager to compete with the Toyota minivan. He introduced the front-wheel drive Dodge Omni and Plymouth Horizon to compete with the Volkswagen Rabbit, and they became instant hits, selling more than 300,000 in their debut year. It was not enough. In 1979, Lee successfully approached Congress for a loan guarantee that bailed out Chrysler. The deal meant reducing costs and abandoning the development of the turbine engine after 20 years of development. Continuing its upward surge in overall sales was the Chrysler K car line of compact cars, the Dodge Aries and Plymouth Reliant, which were introduced in 1981, right in the midst of the 1980-1982 recession. Inexpensive, small, and gas efficient, these front-wheel drive cars sold fast and enabled the car company to reintroduce its big flagship model, the Chrysler Imperial, which became the platform for introducing the company's newest technologies, including the fully electronic fuel injection and an all-digital dashboard. These successes enabled Chrysler to pay back the government 7 years earlier than expected. It seemed that nothing could stop Lee now. In 1987, he led Chrysler in the acquisition of AMC, and Jeep became one of the most profitable divisions in the Chrysler family. The Grand Cherokee had almost been completed by the time Chrysler took over AMC, and that model would redefine the brand. Eagle, however, which was part of the AMC acquisition, was already doomed and did not survive under Chrysler. Lee Iacocca was identified with some of the great ad campaigns in automotive history in his pitch, The Pride is Back, which signaled the turnaround of Chrysler, made people identify with the car manufacturing giant much like Rocky, the underdog in the movies, fighting the odds to triumph. With his inimitable marketing talents and on-camera presence, Lee voiced his own trademark phrase for Chrysler, if you can buy a find a better car, buy it. The pitch sold countless cars on its own strength. Lee retired in 1992, and like so many success stories, Chrysler took a nosedive after he left. In 1995, Kerkorian launched a hostile takeover of the company, which ultimately failed. But Kerkorian and Chrysler made a 5-year agreement that included a gag order preventing Lee from speaking publicly about Chrysler. What a betrayal for the man who had been the voice of Detroit for so many years. Not to be defeated, in 2005, he returned as the company's pitchman, promoting the Employee Pricing Plus program and reprising the If You Can Find a Better Car campaign slogan. His new contract included a $1 donation per vehicle sold from July 1st to December 31st, 2005, to the Iacocca Foundation for Type 1 Diabetes Research. His first wife, Mary McCleary, had died of the disease in May 1983. When Chrysler's fate was sadly clear, Lee, who had been out of the loop for many years by that time, was quoted in Newsweek magazine in April 2009 as saying, quote, "This is a sad day for me. It pains me to see my old company, which has meant so much to America, on the ropes. But Chrysler has been in trouble before, and we got through it, and I believe they can do it again. If they're smart, they'll bring together a consortium of workers, plant managers, and dealers to come up with real solutions. These are the folks on the front line, and they're the key to survival. Let's face it, if your car breaks down, you're not going to take it to the White House to get fixed. But if your company breaks down, you've got to go to the experts on the ground, not the bureaucrats. Every day I talk to dealers and managers who are passionate and full of ideas. No one wants Chrysler to survive more than they do. So I say, don't leave them out. Put their passion and ideas to work. Chrysler did declare bankruptcy, and Lee lost part of his pension and a guaranteed company car during his lifetime. Ownership of the new company was assumed by UAW, Fiat, and the governments of the United States and Canada. Late in his career, late in his life, Lee was involved in politics, activism, and philanthropy, and tried his hand at acting. He died July 2nd, 2 days ago, at his home in Bel Air, California, at the age of 94, from complications from Parkinson's disease. This poor son of Italian immigrants was indeed one of America's greatest success stories, and we each of us owe him a lot.
Bravo.
There you go.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Absolutely.
So now we're
going
to switch gears. Pardon the pun. And Johnny, why don't you lead off with this wonderful car that we drove this week?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say was, of course, you've taken up some of that. But the first thing I wanted to say was, as most people who listen to our shows or anything know, our suppliers have had trouble getting cars because of, you know, the changes in the car manufacturers and what they're doing for marketing and advertising and where their dollars are going, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so last week we talked about the new Toyota, and I loved it. I thought it was great, the hottest selling car that Toyota has, the RAV4. And probably 3 or 4 years ago now, I'd actually gone to the local Cadillac dealer here, met the gentleman whose name is Clark. It's Clark Cadillac, and he's the heir to the Clark Cadillac dealership and all the other things. And very, very nice young man, at least young compared to me. And I told him, you know, we introduced ourselves, told him what we did, and told him if we ever got in a bind, could we come to him about maybe just driving a car, just for a day or whatever, just mm-hmm. to get a feel. He said, sure, anytime. And I called him not many days ago, a few days ago, and spoke to him. And he said, of course I remember you. And I said, well, would it be possible for us to get a car to drive? So we don't need to keep it for a week. That's not what I'm after. But I want to be able to talk firsthand about driving a car. He said, what do you want? I said, what would you suggest? And he said, how about the new XT4? I said, that would be wonderful. He said, can you be here this afternoon? I said, sure. And we drove over, and he put us in an XT4. It's one that one of the salesmen actually drives, and he put us mm-hmm. in it and said, here, go, have a good time. And gave us a book on the XT4, which is a complete redesign and all of that kind. You could not ask for nicer people than the people we have dealt with the last couple of weeks in providing cars. Again, it's cars that they would loan or cars or whatever, that kind of thing. But the point of it is these people are – stepped up when we needed help, and they've gone out of their way to be able to help us. And that's it's a wonderful thing. Makes you feel good about, especially where we live, here in North Carolina. And so the whole point of that is, I wanted to mention Clark Cadillac, which is in Pinehurst, but the only thing that would do for the people in Yonkers is, if you come to Pinehurst to play golf, we can certainly show you some really nice dealerships if you're interested in cars. So you might want to drive back to New York in a new Cadillac.
That's a good point.
You're not on.
Honey, however, in our published interview that appears today Yonkers Tribune.
Yeah, where you going?
There you go. You'll see that we do mention up in the metropolitan New York Potemkin Cadillac.
Oh, okay.
On Potemkin Cadillac of Manhattan, 706 11th Avenue. And and there are several other Cadillac dealers in your area, Hezzy. I know that. However,
when I used
to live in New York, I remember Potemkin from the time I was a kid. They've been around a long, long time.
Well, that's the same with Clark here. They've been around forever.
And Clark Automotive has been around forever. And again, thanks very much to Troy Clark, who was kind enough to arrange for us
mm-hmm.
to. But Clark took over after Pinehurst sold the building, which had originally been a Packard dealership. Those were the days, huh? But anyway,
really?
I did want to mention that as we do more of our, as we do our printed reviews, we're going to work with Hezzy to make our listeners aware of who the dealerships are in the metropolitan New York area as well as down here in Pinehurst. Go ahead, honey.
Oh, no, that was pretty much it. And the idea that, and he gave us this new XT4, which is a complete new design, and
beautiful.
For Cadillac. And it's sort of the crossover, smaller SUV. It's a four-cylinder turbo, so it winds up at 258 foot-pounds of torque. So, I mean, it does have some get-up to it, really does. The thing, when you think about electric cars in America, there's only two that come to mind, and Cadillac is probably the first one. And it's just amazing to me when we got this car, and got in this car, and then looked at the price of this car, or the base sticker price of this car. Here's a Cadillac. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, beautiful, I mean, just gorgeous vehicle. Rides like a dream. Starts at $34,000. You can be in a Cadillac.
Yeah, that, you know, the price point actually blew me away. I don't know how
I agree.
The design is exceptional. It really defines the vehicle more than I've ever seen it before. And I like the fact that it's very American to me. It evokes a different direction that is not a copycat of European styling, if you want to call it that, or Japanese or Korean, and that it really makes a statement. And I think America is also looking for that.
I agree with you.
They want a definition
not agree with
in
more.
Their vehicles. Yeah.
Well, and with all the thing, and if you read the information about it online, which you can, it talks about defining luxury from the inside out. The things that I really, that stand out about it, the first thing I noticed, because I always look in the back seat or get in the back seat to try to get a feel for what it's like. The first thing I noticed was the enormous amount of leg room in the back seat, because it's almost like the back seat is designed to make sure that you have plenty of leg room. And it was really comfortable. And so in looking at the Moroni and the write-up about the vehicle, the reason for that is they designed it. There's 39 inches of rear leg room. That's over 3 feet, and it is best in class for rear leg. I just thought that was incredible. And then you still have all the storage space in the back, and you have incredible storage space if you put those back seats down, because we tried it. Okay, it rode like a dream. It's got a 9-speed forward drive, smooth, quiet. Great sound, big display. It's a Cadillac. I mean, it's got the wooden interior paneling kinds of things. It's just, you're right, it's a beautiful vehicle, great mileage, great price, and, of course, one more time, and it's a Cadillac. I just thought it was stunning.
Yeah.
And
you know what I found interesting is also, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I just thought that the styling was unique so that you'd be able to tell it apart from so many other vehicles on the road that have somehow become a cookie-cutter type of look. And this stands out so well. And I think people are looking for something that's unique. And it says something. I don't know exactly what it says. But it says that, hey, I'm a little different, but also I'm prudent financially-wise. You know, this is an unbelievable price point.
I agree. You know, Lori, I think, had in the write-up about it that, like, Cadillac goes back to 1902. And the neat thing about it, when you're talking about the emblem, you see that. I don't care which model of Cadillac you're in. You see that, and you know it's a Cadillac. It's just ingrained in your mind. And so when you see this really beautiful, stylish, XT4, it's obvious immediately that it's a Cadillac. Not only from the styling you're talking about, there's this beautiful emblem, and you can't miss it.
Yeah.
So, and Laurie said, "Is this going to be our next car?" And I wrote about that in the thing we did for the paper. Mm. You know, and that is,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to say the XT4 would be it because Cadillac also has the XTS, the sedans, the XTS, the CTS, the CT5,
mm-hmm.
the CT6, the ATS, which
yeah.
is like a two-seater type of thing. The XT5 and the XT6 are an Escalade. Again, we've got so many models to choose from. But certainly you can find something. I think this is very true today, and you just pointed it out, Hezzy. I certainly think today you can find a Cadillac with whatever you want in the way of luxury at your price point. And I think you can find that today more than ever before. If you want a Cadillac, you certainly can get one.
Yeah, because aspiring to get a Cadillac is now reachable, whereas maybe in the past it wasn't.
Yeah.
That seems to be evidence as well.
Right, right.
Well, which is cool. Very, very good.
Hold on, hold on.
So what
Lori's trying to say something, but she's not on again.
I've had it on mute. One thing that's interesting about Cadillac, as Donnie mentioned, is Cadillac dates back to 1902, and General Motors purchased it from Ford in 1909. And the thing that we need to point out here, it's one of the few brands of cars made in the first half of the 1900s, the 20th century, that survived the World War I, the Depression, World War II.
Mm.
Well, that's one thing, as I was going to say, too. We were talking about Lee I. Cook and how he brought Chrysler back and did all those kinds of things. You know, Cadillacs just sailed along right through all of these things. There's always
Absolutely.
Been Cadillacs.
It's prevailed. And one of the reasons, you know, it was making custom-built cars with V12 and V16 engines during the Depression, and yet they still managed to sell. It was not just because the cars, I'm sure, were not cheap even then, but somehow the company managed to stay balanced. What we just heard about with Lee Iacocca was it's always a balance point. It's a balance point in any business, you know, production versus costs.
Yeah.
But Cadillac, on the strength of its the term, it's the Cadillac of whatever the product may be. Well, it's because of their tremendous workmanship, high class, and the fact that it did start out as, you know, as virtually an entirely handmade custom car company. But when we got into that car, there's a whole slew of stuff that I didn't think about or feel I had to say because, simply put, I was in a Cadillac. And that's all you have to say. I mean, it's you know it's going to be outstanding, and it is. I mean, I can't. The only thing I can say about Cadillac, and driving this XT4, that's different from anything else that I've ever said about Cadillac, Johnny's already covered, which is, can you believe you can get into a SUV like this for MSRP of $34,000? I mean, that's insanity.
Hey, we're running out of time, and you wanted to talk about cars that aren't around anymore, and I really wanted to.
Well, I know that we were. We were going to talk today about the DeLorean and the Saab, and when I started to research DeLorean, his story is so dramatic, and it's.
Yeah,
so,
I thought that was interesting.
and I thought, how can I put DeLorean in the same show as Lee Iacocca? It's not fair.
Well, you can't.
You just
there
can't.
Other thing. Well, a lot of the Chryslers that you mentioned when you were talking about Lee Iacocca, I remember those cars. A lot of young people won't even remember them, but I remember them. The Velare. You remember it went with the song?
Yeah.
But I remember that and the recalls and all the things that Chrysler was doing, and I remember Lee Iacocca being on TV and saying those things. And when he said it, you know what? You believed it. That guy he came across as, I'm telling you the truth. And so it really did turn Chrysler around. That's not a joke. That's reality.
So if it's all right with you, we'll talk about DeLorean. And Saab's a different matter entirely, but we'll talk about DeLorean next week because, frankly, talking about a guy who you know, was accused of getting drug money in order to pay off the debts of and keep his car company going, and was really only in the picture for 7 years. It just paled compared to all of the great things that Lee Iacocca managed to do. So I just thought I'd rather keep them entirely separate. It's too much.
No, that's fine.
Much drama for one show.
Give me another one. Pick something else.
Well, the other one that we were going to talk about was Saab.
Well, there you go again. Saab was actually, I think, founded by guys who were it had to do with jet engines. I don't remember where they were.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
And so they really understood propulsion and all that kind of thing. And Saabs, for some reason, never caught on here.
Well, they were a quirky, by saying quirky, they were a distinctive body design. I mean, you could always tell a Saab. You could always tell.
Yeah.
They were kind of bulbous, and they were kind of quirky. And the people that were devoted to Saab, I'm shocked Saab doesn't exist anymore because it was such a dependable car.
Yeah. And that's probably again.
You know what? They got beat by the competition because they were going upscale probably faster than the industry was able to tolerate, and yet there were some other competition that came in at a lesser cost, and I think they were driven out by price.
I mean, if you
not
stand
because
back
of
heavy
excellence
and look at
in
all
product.
Yeah, and if you stand back and look at all the factors in the world that have influenced how manufacturers like Saab have managed to exist and then die. I mean, just as we were talking about, you know, the recessions, the great recessions, the competition in car companies for technology, the buyer market wanting, you know, its fluctuation in taste from wanting something that's cheap and small and not a gas guzzler to something that's, you know, a big SUV that gas is not an issue. So there's been so many there are so many variations. There are so many factors that impact the success of a car. And of course, with Lee Iacocca's story, we've got a man there that he was savvy, he was smart, and he jumped in with both feet. I mean, he was an engineer to start. He became a pitchman because he knew how to do that by nature.
Let's go back for Saab for just a minute.
Okay.
The thing about the Saab, which you brought up, and then Hezzy brought up, is we were talking about it was designed by these engineers who knew jet engines. And so the whole, I still remember this, but the thrust, nice use of the word, for the Saab was the engineering that made it a powerful, fast car. And now, you switched over and said all these things that influence it, like gas consumption of that. When the Saab wasn't really known as a vehicle that had great gas mileage, that wasn't its claim to fame. And like Hesse said, this Saab was based around this concept of this incredible engine, incredible engineering, and then improving on that. But there's only a certain small part of your populace who I think would appreciate that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not a standard, let's put the family
target
in and go someplace. Yeah. You don't just buy that when you got two kids and, you know, you're having trouble making the mortgage payment. It was geared toward a really specific audience, and it probably sold a lot of cars to that particular audience. But I don't think that audience was enough to keep the car company in existence. Let's go back
to
Cadillac.
Because if you remember, they were predominantly in the New England area, in the northern part of the country. Their front-wheel drive is really what made them so well-respected because they were able to travel in the snow, in the deep, heavy snow.
Right.
And you could count on it. They were dependable. And then they got the competition, which undermined their capacity to make a buck, and yet the competition was strong as well, and is still to
well.
This
and
day.
You had that was back during also when Lori was talking about when you had this first depression and stuff, and certainly New England gets hit worse as bad as anybody when you go through those types of times. So yeah, when money's tight, people aren't going to buy that kind of vehicle, and that really hurts the high end. You know, the high-end expensive vehicles. So, it all makes perfect sense. You sort of have to look at all the factors, but, I think it all makes perfect sense at that point.
Yeah, I was hoping it would come
Cadillac
back.
Cadillac survived all
that. I thought that Saab was going to be able to come back because the people who owned it for a little while. I thought they moved into China and they were trying to redevelop something else, but I'm not sure about that anymore. It's too cloudy in my mind.
Yeah, mine too. I don't remember. But apparently they didn't think it was good enough market either, or they would have stayed with it.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's,
all right, well, we're about at the end. Lori, so I can hear in the other room trying to say something.
Oh,
but.
Right, here I am again. Okay, so to close up.
Okay,
our,
we need
our
telephones.
I just want to say one thing which has nothing to do with cars, but it does.
Uh-huh.
My old grandfather, I've said this so many times on this show, would say, buy American or buy America. And I just read in the paper this morning that, of all companies, Walmart has just announced they're going to do a $1.2 billion infusion of cash in China manufacturing, into China.
Yeah.
And all I can think of is, you know, here's our, I think that Mr.
Walton
would have a fit if he was alive. And
well, there's a lot of things about Walmart that Mr. Walton had envisioned, I assure you of that.
And so I guess that, you know, on this 4th of July, I'm going to end quoting my grandfather again, buy American or bye-bye America.
Cadillac.
And my very last thing is we drove the 2019 Cadillac XT4 front-wheel drive Sport, which has a base MSRP of $39,000, and we drove it totally loaded for $50,000. Great car. Go to your Cadillac dealer and test drive one. This is a winner. And
all right.
And Hezzy, we'll talk to you next week. Happy 4th.
Happy 4th, buddy.
Absolutely. I look forward. Happy 4th to all of you. Be well.
Thank
Enjoy the
you.
Parade
Bye.
Tonight. It's going to be an extravaganza. Not to be believed. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Bye.
Be well.
Bye now.
Bye. Thank you. Well, there we have it, folks. The driving me crazy crowd, but they're not really driving me crazy. And I just think it's always such a pleasure to hear them both talk. What a wonderful attribution to the, I guess, the stature and the capacity and the integrity of a great man in the automotive industry. And I think he went even beyond the automotive industry. He was like a household name. And Lee Iacocca lives on. And he was always there. Always think about him, maybe for the older people like me, but it's just that his heritage lives on in the vehicles that we see and his infusion of such integrity and thought and concepts that were not realized until he came along. And evidently they live on today in the product lines that we see, which is really fascinating. So that's something to think about. The next caller we're going to get is that of Shawn Patterson Howard. And she is a candidate for, she was a candidate for the Mount Vernon mayor. She won the Democratic Party primary election, which was certified by the Westchester County Board of Elections yesterday. She had a plurality of 209 votes, and that was certified. All sorts of allegations and drama and this, that, and the other to try to undermine the prospect of her 200-point lead, which actually went beyond where it was before, and ends up at 209 votes, which only goes to point out that if you want somebody, you got to get out there and vote, and it does matter. Every vote counts. So it's really, really pertinent that people get out and vote. So what's really exciting is that here we have a Democratic primary winner. And because Mount Vernon is regarded as a predominantly Democratic registered city of voters, I think over 80% of the populace is regarded as Democrat. And so the winner of the Democratic primary, which took place on the 29th, of June, actually is the presumptive mayor. Now, we must also recognize that there are people who ran as Democrats in the Democratic primary who also sought or eventually got the Republican endorsement, and it is very likely that we're going to see the Mount Vernon City Council President, Andre Wallace, bringing about a challenge to the Democratic primary designee and winner, and he'll challenge her from the Republican side of the equation. And then the prospect of also a disgruntled mayor who has not gained the support of the populace is very telling. When you consider all the votes that were cast for mayor, 70% of the people said, "Sorry, Mr. Mayor Richard Thomas, we don't care to have you come back." So 70% of the vote was not for Thomas. Only about 30% was. That's a frightening statistic. 3.5 years into the first term of office, that is insane. And when you compare that, for example, to a mayor like in Yonkers, who's been in office for 2 terms, is now going to be running for the 3rd term. There was an extension afforded him. And what's interesting is that after 2 terms, or 7.5 years in office, when he was engaged in the primary, even though I thought he had like really a waste of time challengers, which didn't amount to very much of anything, the mayor of Yonkers got 75% of the vote cast for him. So they evidently believe in his candidacy. They believe in his legacy of 7.5 years, and they wanted to continue. Whether what the basis is for their wanting to continue is in question, always is. But you normally expect an incumbent to be able to gain and hold on to a very, very large proportion of the electorate support. And certainly Mike Spano has been able to do that in the city of Yonkers, but in Mount Vernon, we're seeing a total collapse of interest and support of the present mayor in Mount Vernon. And that's troubling. It's troubling to see that happen, but it's also very disappointing because it seemed that Mayor Thomas had all the attributes that were pertinent for someone to succeed in political office, particularly in the realm of mayor. But evidently that failed because the entire city is at each other's throats. And it's shown to be wanting, which is really very, very frightening. Anyway, so that seems to be the story here. For some reason, Ms. Patterson Howard doesn't seem to be able to make it here today. I'm sure the whole world is clamoring for a statement or who knows what, and a congratulation. And it is the 4th of July, so there'll be a lot of events and she'll be pulled from left to right and so on and so forth. But we certainly wish her well. It seems that the majority of people in Mount Vernon sought her out. Beyond the myriad of candidates that were running, you had Andre Wallace, the city council president. You had the mayor, Richard Thomas. You had former mayor Ernie Davis. You had who lost completely. He never even got his enough signatures validated. There was a woman by the name of Delia Farquharson who wanted to engage in a write-in vote. That never amounted to anything either. She's still a sitting city council person. I don't know if she's been eclipsed by some other challengers because I wasn't that familiar with the city council candidates in Mount Vernon. And, you know, a lot of people just didn't reach out, and it just is, you know, what it is. Look, the thing is that what is exciting here is that here you had an extremely credible individual who was untainted by all sorts of conduct that were deleterious to her. They tried to finger point the competition, tried to finger point and make believe she was the issue and she was the problem, and there was a diminution of her patina based on allegations that never were proved right because they were wrong. And it was just a way to besmirch her in the hope that they would be able to throw out a major challenger, and that major challenger proved to be the preeminent vote getter, and there is a reason for that. And oh, we should have, I didn't want to forget, Clyde A. Isley was also another candidate, but even though polls suggested that he was running very high and was elevated all the way to the last polls, he evidently, though, came in fourth. The person that came in third was Andre Wallace, the city council president, who will be able to retain his seat because he doesn't lose it by, you know, losing out on in this primary. But he's certainly challenged, and there are many things that he's done, including sit on particular boards that the city charter does not permit. So let's hope that all these inconsistencies and lack of adherence to city charter regulations and will be adhered to into the future. So there are many challenges that need to be investigated with respect to Andre Wallace, and hopefully there will be that the candidates and the powers that be will not be as timid as they were in this past election process, because it was extremely timid. It was innocuous, as so often is the case. And it was just trying an effort to deflect from every allegation and assertion that was made, whether it was correct or it was incorrect. And that seemed to be the process. And that I've been seeing that same process on the national level as well. And it actually does the public an injustice, because the public is not always aware of what goes on a consistent basis. And the reason they're not aware is not because they're disinterested. They are very interested. It's their money, after all. Governance is supposed to serve them and not the other way around. Many people in politics have forgotten that. But it does seem as though we may have a candidate that the public, and certainly in Mount Vernon, has recognized to be one that they can count on. So her integrity is the first thing that you see when you look at her, and you see her demeanor, you see her attitude, you see her stance, you hear her. She gives ideas, expression, and she also tells it like it is, and so she doesn't shrink away, and that's important. But I also noticed that everyone on the platform running for mayor and other offices, which I did not hear very much about, so I'm not going to even comment about all the others, like city council people and whatever else is running in that city. Everything, I could just focus so much on everything that goes on in Mount Vernon, but certainly the race for mayor was crucial. It was crucial and prudent to follow that, and we did. And but one thing is also very, very certain is that we must get away from the timidity, the lack of giving expression to what is wrong. And quite often we found that until we brought up the issue, it was not even considered. And that is very telling. But that's telling not of us. It's telling of a process which no longer permits the lectern from which candidates can speak with honesty and integrity, and also give explanation as to why things are wrong or why they may be right. Not everything is a contrarian position to positiveness, but rather contrarian as well to negative stuff as well. And this is what we need to find out. This is what we need to know. And this is what we often are not told. And there's a lack of press. That's the problem. There is no press. The press has died. And I don't know if it'll ever be resuscitated. The model of creating a platform that is well-read, you know, such as an internet website, is also floundering in many, many cases. And there's a challenge of press on many, many levels. So it's very hard to understand at the end of the day who's going to be running the show. Will the public be able to vote for those that they believe are good for them? Will they throw the bums out after 4 years when it comes to a mayoral position if they haven't done a good job? And then the question is, how do you define a good job? What is a good job with respect to a candidate that's already in place and has earned, let's say, 4 years of something? And do we even know what's going on and what's wrong in a particular administration, or is it just fluff? And all we hear is what's expressed from the communication departments of one particular municipality or another. Everything sounds wonderful. And you know what? Nothing is really being said and nothing is being expressed. And yet you have municipalities who have the capacity of creating their own TV shows, their own radio shows. They're out there in media stronger and bigger than anyone else. They've got the advertising companies to back them up and to promote all these goodwill, wonderful press releases that may not be lying, of course, and they're not straightforward either, but they try to paint everything in the best of light, and yet it's only half the facts. And that's really what's so difficult. And it's so hard to find people of credibility in the industry. And it's a shame that that's what's happened. And at one time, when you could go to media, you were able to go, for example, to a newspaper or to a television or a radio station. And they had already amassed a sense of credibility and integrity in their reporting. And then there were some that had a particular political leaning, as opposed to others that might have a different leaning. Or sometimes you had the same leaning, but from different issues, different publications, different outlets, whether it were different newspapers. Hey, there was a time when in New York City, for example, there were 12 to 15 newspapers. Now, what's it come down to? We have only three, in a sense. We've got the New York Times. We've got the Daily News. We've got the New York Post. And then we also have the Wall Street Journal. But the Wall Street Journal is not specific to New York all the time, New York City all the time. And then certainly it doesn't cover a lot of the local communities around and even those that abut the metropolitan area of New York City. So, you know, you need to have local input, and there's very little of that. And even those that are in the local marketplace are under tremendous assault, whether people recognize it or not. So these are the major issues and major concerns. Well, it looks like we're about 11 minutes from the end of this particular segment. So I just can't imagine that Ms. Howard will be able to join us. What a pity. But I'm sure that if she could, she'd be able to make it. And it's just unfortunate, because it would be nice to give her a brava for such a wonderful, wonderful outcome, well fought, well maintained. She's kept her cool. She's been calm and collected. She's not hysterical in any way, shape, or form. And the bottom line is, she's just a balanced individual. She knows what to say, how to say it, and give it expression. And once she takes office, which we expect after the general election, despite the fact that she's going to be meeting the challenger of a write-in vote from the present mayor, whom 70% of the people say, we don't want you. Forget about it. You're one of the problems. We have this mess. And Andre Wallace, as a Republican, is very unlikely to garner more than 20% of the vote. Should that be the case? Because no more than 20% of the people who are registered, you need not register from a particular party to vote in the general election. You could vote for anybody. So at this point, though, I don't expect even 20% of the vote will come out for Andre Wallace, even though he'll be running as a Republican. It will possibly do well for the Republican Party to make potential people who have more conservative views than the Democrats may be thought to have in Mount Vernon. It may actually embellish the roles of the Republican Party, and it's conceivable that that may just happen. Also, we hear that the Conservative Party is going to be running a candidate. I think her name is Yarosh. I don't remember her first name. She's always been inconsequential in the political scheme of things, but she's there holding on the banner and raising the flag for the Conservative Party line. And so we'll expect to see her. So you've got Thomas as a Republican, Yarosh as a conservative. You'll have a write-in vote by however you want to define Richard Thomas, the incumbent mayor. And, of course, you'll have the majority leader, the majority vote getter of over 50% of the 50% of the all the votes that came in. No, I'm sorry, I'm making a mistake. So I'm just losing it because I'm trying to think the numbers out and I can't. So the point is that she was the one that won. Her numbers were certified. So she's the one that will be the Democratic candidate, and she'll be there to run under the Democratic Party line. And so that's what you have over there. So it's going to be, again, let's see, Sean Patterson Howard, Richard Thomas, Andre Wallace, and this woman, last name Yarosh. And so you're going to have another four-way race this time, and we'll see what happens. And it will be interesting as well to see if the Democratic Party has been able to sustain its viability and pertinence in the city of Mount Vernon, because so many people are in a sense of discord with respect to what they believe is they are hearing from the Democratic Party. And it seems that their challenges to the Mount Vernon Democratic leader, Reggie Lafayette, is also the chairman, the Democratic chairman of Westchester County. And so his leadership there. And then there were so many people that were Democrats, very well respected. You had the county executive, George Latimer. You had Gary Pretlow, the assemblyman. You had Lyndon Williams, the Westchester County board legislator. You had, those are like some of the biggest figures. Oh, and of course, we had the deputy Westchester County executive. And so that's Ken Jenkins. And who else do we have? And of course, Reginald Lafayette was there also to endorse. They endorsed. I'm starting to lose my track of mind because I'm thinking about too many things at the same time. The point of all that was that, in a sense, all those figures, all top people in the Democratic Party, what they were doing was they were trying to validate and promote the position of a former police commissioner of Mount Vernon who actually was regarded as the front runner. So you got support from everybody in the Democratic Party that was somehow engaged in what was going on in Mount Vernon. Yet the clout of the Democratic top leadership from every conceivable level floundered because the public didn't vote according to their position and their perspective and the person that they wanted to see, become the next mayor. So that was Clyde Isley. He got the support of everybody in the Democratic Party mechanism, and yet he came in a distant fourth. A distant fourth. When you think about that, and then the one that came in a little bit ahead of him was Andre Wallace, and then the one that came in above him was Richard Thomas, the present mayor, who probably just got it based on the fact that his name was more recognized than otherwise. But just that, a lot of people didn't even know the man is going to have to go to court on the 8th of July. It's only a few days away, and there's a case against him. So there are a lot of issues that people didn't even know that he was engaged in some sort of litigation, which is very troubling. But then it's not troubling that the people don't know it. Of course, it's disconcerting that they're unaware of it. But again, how can people be aware if there's no discussion of these issues over and over again? The media is non-existent. The television is too quick. They give you a 60-second, even a 90-second dissertation on very complex issues, and they are not vetted as much as they must in order for people to recognize the real issues. It's not that they're lying. It's just that they're not complete. And if you don't give a complete dissertation of the issue, then the public is incapable of making a decision of what is the subject matter, what the issues are, and also they can't even contemplate remedies to that particular issue and concern. And that is the responsibility of media, which is not doing its job because there may not be enough support for the medium in which the media is working. So whether it be television or radio or print, it's not functioning, and the online is trying to pick up the slack, but not everyone is capable of doing such a phenomenal job. It's up to the public to find these outlets, and we're also creating niche marketplaces so that there can be just so much expertise on one site. The generic capacity of subject matter, the general, expression of ideas and concepts on disparate perspectives and views is just so difficult. So therefore, you'll end up having a particular interest, like whether it be about nature, and that's all they'll talk about, nature. And then, but instead of getting the complete picture of nature, as was done maybe 20 or 30 years ago, to the best of their capacity and knowledge at the time, we're going to end up having to go into niche marketplaces. Oh, we'll find out what's going on in the Antarctic or in Antarctica, or we'll find out what's happening in the Pacific Oceans or in the Mediterranean or the Atlantic Oceans or in the North or the South or wherever. You know, these are all different places. Then you have different strata in the oceans, for example. So you might look at what's happening at the Mariana Trench, the deepest place in the world on Earth. And then you might look at something else like the Dead Sea, which is from the ground up, it is the lowest place elevation-wise in the world. But certainly not as deep as the trench, the Mariana Trench in the Pacific. So there are just so many ways to slice it and dice it. That's why, for example, you may have the national media focus in just on the president and the presidential races that are expected. And yet at the same time, those publications don't even take the time because they don't have the personnel to actually delve into the local marketplace. And then you've got publications that do have an interest because their environment is such that it causes them, for example, the Times Union in Albany, their central focus is that of what's going on in the New York State Legislature. because that's their home. That place lives and breathes politics. But that's the way the place is. And in order to be able to be relevant at all times, one has to focus attention to the different legislation that's coming beforehand, and also at the same time to recognize the, I guess, the demeanor, the direction of a population. It's hard to tell because the population that actually moves Albany is from throughout the state. So it's hard to be able to differentiate, for example, the difference between those that represent people in the New York State Legislature as senators or assembly people, and yet at the same time they may be representing either a place in Brooklyn, or they may represent a place in Utica or in Buffalo or in Schenectady or in Rochester or what have you. Very hard to be able to get a sense of the direction and the demeanor of so many different people. And then you get the discord that may be ripping the capacity to decipher all of this, because you have people that are on one side of the political divide and there are others in another side of the political divide. There may even be a third a slice of interest somewhere, somehow. And then there are also subjects that need to be covered. And not everybody has the expertise to cover issues of fuel, consumption, electricity, energy, the environment, clean air, clean water, different industry regulating this, that, or the other. It is mind-boggling. But one of the problems is that whereas in the past we were able to look to, let's say, television and newspapers and radio as well to get a sense of what was happening in our world, today we don't have that expertise explaining it to us, and we don't even have the capacity to make a judgment call of who's right, who's wrong. And in the past they didn't always validate as much as we thought they did. But they asserted what they did, and that's what we ended up believing, and whether right or wrong. And so this is where we've come. It's a frightening state of affairs, and we'll see where that goes. So I see it's a little bit already after 11, so let's just quickly, I guess we won't be able to hear from Ms. Patterson Howard, but we wish her well, and we wish her well because we want to wish Mount Vernon well, and so we are pleased for her success in the primary, and that her numbers were validated and certified by the Westchester County Board of Elections, and we hope that this will, by right, she should be the presumptive mayor, despite the fact that there will be a general election in which she will face off with possibly three other candidates that will challenge her. But because the Democratic and the people who belong to the Democratic Party are affiliated with the party and are registered as party members, it is likely that they will be able to eclipse all other challengers, because 80% of the populace is registered as Democrats. I can't see anyone abandoning their Democratic leaning and vote for someone that is not running as a Democrat. So we'll see where that goes. All right, let's quickly then follow on. Let's quickly follow up with what's happening on other parts of the world and see what's going on with the news. Let me just see, bear with me a moment. We'll try to cover this quickly. Well, one of the biggest issues that's coming about, of course, unfortunately, is that the media is and people, and that's what media is doing, they're giving voice to accusations that the Independence Day parade is being hijacked by Trump, who is promising that it will be a show of a lifetime. And so this is the story. It seems that tanks in the heart of Washington, fighter jets screaming overhead, and a speech from the Lincoln Memorial, President Donald Trump is promising the show of a lifetime as he prepares to turn the 4th of July seemingly into a personal primetime extravaganza. But then maybe what he's doing is going to be more over the top than what's been done in the past. But these are different times, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. So it seems that the commander-in-chief, an erstwhile Manhattan showman, plans to tear up another norm. That's what critics are saying, by hijacking traditionally nonpartisan Independence Day as he seeks re-election. But that's their perspective. In modern times, presidents have tended to stand back and let the people lead the party. Well, so they say, but not Trump. And that's not necessarily the case. So anyway, our July 4th salute to America at the Lincoln Memorial is looking to be really big. It will be the show of a lifetime, Trump tweeted on Wednesday. We have the greatest economy anywhere in the world, he says. We have the greatest military anywhere in the world. Not bad, he added. And usually, said Rich Hanley, a media and popular culture expert at Quinnipiac University, on July 4 works as a kind of national ceasefire. Quote, then the 5th, they go back to normal, he says. Well, but this year, the familiar script is being given a rewrite. And I don't know if that's necessarily bad. It's hard to prejudge. At around 6:30 local time this evening, East Coast time, Trump will take to the hallowed steps of the Lincoln Memorial for an unprecedented event that will include a televised address, military hardware, and a giant fireworks display. The nation's top military brass will have a front row seat. He's calling this event a, quote, salute to America, end quote, honoring the armed forces. And he'll speak at the Lincoln Memorial in front of a ticket-only VIP crowd of Republican donors, administration and campaign officials, family members, and those who flock to see him or protest what they see as a divisive intrusion on a traditionally unifying national holiday. You know what? Some people have to get over the fact that there was a tradition. A tradition means absolutely nothing. It's what people did. Were they lazy to keep on repeating the same old thing? So maybe President Trump is not being lazy about it. He wanted to show what he believes is the image that he wants portrayed, not only on the world stage, but he wants it portrayed here in the United States. That is his message. Take it or leave it. You don't necessarily have to like it. And but he's in office, so you can't forget the fact that he won the vote. Some people say, well, he only won the Electoral College vote. Well, you know what? That's the way it's been all this time. If you want to change it, then they can go ahead and change it. I don't see any legislation being thrown out there by the Democrats saying, we've got to change it. Let's do it. Here's a plan. This is the way it can work. Well, you know what? Until you get it done, you got nothing. It's just talk. Anyway, so President Trump is calling. Then he says that the modified Boeing 747 used as Air Force One will fly over. Wow. As will noisy, powerful warplanes expected to include F-35s. And jets from the Navy's Blue Angels airshow team. Wow. A handful of tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles are stationed near the Lincoln Memorial. Although the enormous machines are not expected to roll, as their tracks would likely tear up city streets, the center of attention will not be the weapons or the nearly $1 million worth of fireworks that are in the works, a donation from two big manufacturers. And that's important, you know, because everyone says, oh, look, he's spending all the taxpayers' money. No, this is a donation from two big manufacturers. Take it or leave it. Rather, it will be Trump. And so it is. And I don't know if you could say that everybody sat back and didn't want to take any bows at the past 4th of July. Anyway, so he says, your favorite president, me, he tweeted when announcing the show. July 4 is a unique holiday in that it is hyper-patriotic, but free from usual Republican-Democratic fighting, and it is far more civic than military in nature. Inserting such a high-profile presidential address from the festivities risks changing that, given that the polarizing Trump is supporting is supported by just over 40% of the country ahead of his 2020 re-election bid and fervently opposed by much of the remaining electorate. Well, that might be the case. But the point is, maybe this will make a difference. Maybe what people need to hear is the message that Trump is trying to promote on a world stage, and he wants people in America to know exactly what he thinks and what he believes. And maybe this will be the trick that will change people's perspectives. It might actually solidify or cause a stasis in perspectives. Maybe he will only be 40% when he runs for re-election, but I doubt it. I think the closer you get to the final outcome, when you find out that, well, he's the Republican standing for president and there'll be a Democrat that will be chosen, we'll see where the public go. Anyway, Trump's ego is so large that he's holding this 4th of July campaign rally in a desperate cry for attention, and everyone knows it. That's what Senator Chuck Schumer wrote on Twitter. Chuck Schumer, you know what? He's been practically unseen in all the years he was in office. You really wonder, why was he reelected over and over? Because people do exactly the same thing over and over. He hasn't done squat in the 3.5 years of this presidency that means to matter. And he never even won the majority leadership role in the Senate. So you gotta really have to wonder, like, just how much clout does this man have? And, well, good for him. He's the minority leader of the Senate. It doesn't amount to a squat. Anyway, counter-protesters plan to bring their own kind of political fireworks to the National Mall. The grassy park running 2 miles from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. And then a leftist organization's Code Pink is deploying its baby Trump blimp, a large inflated doll depicting the president in nappies. But the National Park Service denied permission to fill the inflatable with helium, so the depiction of a cranky infantile Trump will stay on the ground. On Wednesday, one Code Pink activist held a sign near an armored vehicle that read, "Tanks, but no tanks." And hashtag boycott Trump's 4th of July was trending on Twitter in the United States. It's interesting. That's what people like to do today. They like to just, send Twitter notes. They don't vote the way they claim, the way they espouse themselves to be on Twitter or somewhere else or Facebook or Instagram. They just like to be out there. They want to be part of the storyline, but they don't necessarily vote along those lines. Some of them don't even bother to vote. So it's going to be very interesting to see where all this goes. So then Julian Castro is a presidential hopeful, said instead of addressing something like veteran homelessness, he's spending it on boosting his ego with a parade that's fundamentally about him. And Julian Castro said, what a waste of money. Well, you know what? It may seem like a waste of money to some, but then I haven't heard Julian Castro address the veteran homelessness issue himself. And has he done anything in Texas to make that difference? And how so? You know, these people always have something to say. But again, what have you done to make a correction within your purview that impacts you viscerally in such a way? Inevitably, that's the problem. We don't see that. We just see talk, derogatory talk, but we find very little response to all these concerns and issues. Anyway, Trump is regarded as a former reality TV star, and he's tapping his considerable showmanship skills ahead of the event. Quote, we're going to have planes going overhead, the best fighter jets in the world, and other planes too, and we're going to have some tanks stationed outside, said Trump at a press conference in the Oval Office. Just being up on the Lincoln Memorial will guarantee unbeatable pictures. The statue honoring civil rights president Abraham Lincoln is famous as the location of Martin Luther King Jr.'s epic 1963 I Have a Dream speech. Well, we'll see if President Trump can come up with something as eloquent. Anyway, the big issue is, has all this been inspired by Bastille Day in France? Well, but Trump's inspiration seems to be taken less from the civil rights crime than a Bastille Day military parade he attended in 2017 as a guest of French President Emmanuel Macron. So impressed was Trump that he came up with the idea of putting on a major extravaganza for Veterans Day, which is marked on November 11. But an outcry over the almost $100 million price tag meant it had to be scrapped. Now he'll get a scaled-back version. As he prepared for the big day, Trump downplayed the issue of cost. The cost of our great salute to America tomorrow will be very little compared with what it is worth, Trump wrote. And I think that's what the president is counting on. It will be a story of the century, probably around the world. Anyway, he says, so Trump says, we own the planes. We have the pilots. The airport is right next door, meaning Andrews. All we need is the fuel. We own the tanks and all. Fireworks are donated by two of the greats. Nice, he says. So that is the story, and that's what's going on there. Now, let me quickly go back to our studio screen. Okay, so I wanted to cover that with you, and let me just quickly look and see what else is happening. This is very frightening because it scared people half to death, and I can't even imagine the horror of it to them. It seems that tourists have fled as a volcano erupts on the Italian island of Stromboli. A volcano on the Italian island of Stromboli erupted dramatically yesterday, killing a hiker and sending tourists fleeing into the sea. The volcano is known to be active, but on Wednesday, there were two particularly powerful explosions. Unfortunately, one man is dead. There are a few injured, but none seriously, emergency worker Calogero Fotti told RAI television. So the dead man was a 35-year-old from Messina in Sicily who was walking with a Brazilian companion who was found dehydrated and in a state of shock, the AGI news agency reported. They were walking below the 400-meter, that's about 1,200-feet altitude limit, above which a guide is required. A Navy boat has been sent to the 12-square-kilometer, that's about a 5-square-mile island, for a possible mass evacuation, with 70 inhabitants and tourists already evacuated. It was like being in hell because of the rain of fire coming from the sky. Italian news agencies quoted local priest Giovanni Longo as saying, he said it was not known if there were any hikers on the volcano at the time of the eruption, which caused fires around the village of Ginostra. Well, Stromboli is topped by an active volcano, which is a magnet for tourists from early spring each year. Italian media reported that some tourists had fled into the sea after the eruption, while others had barricaded themselves into homes. Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, INGV, said there were two huge explosions on the central southern side of the volcano's crater at about mid-afternoon Wednesday, one of the biggest explosions ever recorded on the island. The explosions were preceded by lava spills from all the active mouths of the crater terrace, said the INGV, prompting a 2-kilometer-high plumes of smoke. So it's like 2 kilometers. Well, it's about like half a mile or so, a third of a mile up. It's been a long time since we had an eruption of this magnitude. The former local councillor Gianluca Giuffri I told RAI News, and my experience and of those who have been living here for generations leads us to believe that the situation will calm down again, but we must be cautious, he said. A firefighting airplane could not put out fires in the area because of the amount of smoke, Italian media reported. The INGV said it was monitoring the situation. A previous massive eruption in December of 2002 prompted a tidal wave after magma from a particularly violent eruption cascaded into the sea. 6 people were injured. Piers, boats, and some buildings were swept away. Access to the island was forbidden to outsiders for over a month amid the risk of further landslides, and scientists set up electronic observation stations to monitor volcanic activity. 4/5 of the island's population of around 500 decided to leave for the Aeolian Island Administrative Center of Lipari, whose schools have taken on Stromboli's children under the disaster, or since the disaster. Now, Stromboli was made famous in the 1950 film of the same name by Roberto Rossellini, starring Ingrid Bergman, that was his wife, who and is a major tourist attraction with thousands of people visiting its lava-spitting crater each year. Stromboli is part of the 7-island Aeolian archipelago just off Sicily in southern Italy. And so that's the situation there. Very, very intriguing. Let me go back for a moment to our studio screen. We're fine. And let's quickly look at some other abnormality or aberration of climate. It seems over 1 million were ordered to evacuate as heavy rains lashed out in Japan. So fears of landslides and flooding put southern Japan on high alert today as heavy rains continued to pummel the region, prompting authorities to order more than 1 million people to evacuate. Unbelievable. It's so frightening. It's just amazing. And then let's look at what's going on in India. Don't always hear much about there, but the India Congress Party leader, Rahul Gandhi, has resigned. Rahul Gandhi resigned yesterday as president of India's opposition Congress Party, long linked to his politically powerful family, to take responsibility for its crushing defeat in recent elections. Gandhi announced his resignation on Twitter, saying he was stepping down because accountability is, quote, critical for the future growth of our party, he said. He said rebuilding the party requires hard decisions and, quote, numerous people will have to be made accountable for the failure, end quote. It would be unjust to hold others accountable but ignore my own responsibility as president of the party, Gandhi said in his resignation letter. It was unclear whether the left-of-center secular party would accept his resignation. Gandhi's family, starting with his great-grandfather, Jawaharlal Nehru, has produced 3 prime ministers. 2 of them, his grandmother Indira Gandhi and father Rajiv Gandhi, were assassinated in office. Rahul Gandhi lost his own seat, long a Congress Party bastion, in the recent elections, marking the end of an era for modern India's most powerful political dynasty. However, he won a seat from another constituency. He had been talking of quitting since the results of the elections were announced in May, but party officials urged him to stay on. On Tuesday, a Congress activist reportedly tried to hang himself from a tree outside the party office in New Delhi, but was saved by party colleagues. Dozens of other party supporters joined a strike to pressure Gandhi not to resign. In the election, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party won 303 out of the 542 seats in the Lok Sabha, the lower house of parliament, and well beyond the simple majority needed to form a government. The Congress Party won 52 seats, and the All India Trinamool Party, or Congress, led by West Bengal Chief Minister Mamata Banerjee, won 22. So Gandhi said in his resignation that the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, used state organizations to help it win the election. And it's like, you know, well, why didn't you say that before? And what could you have done to change that? You know, it's always like rewriting history. Where were you then? Anyway, we didn't fight a political party in the 2019 election. Rather, we fought the entire machinery of the Indian state every institution of which was marshaled against the opposition, Gandhi said. It is now crystal clear that our once cherished institutional neutrality no longer exists in India. Well, then you should have been aware of it. That's what's happening here in the United States, too. He said the BJP is systematically crushing the voice of the Indian people and that it is his party's duty to, quote, defend these voices. Well, we don't hear them. Anyway, our democracy has been fundamentally weakened. There is a real danger that from now on, elections will go from being a determinant of India's future to a mere ritual, he said. This capture of power will result in unimaginable levels of violence and pain for India. Well, that's what he's there to speak about and speak to. So after inheriting his power, Rahul Gandhi long distanced himself from political life, even after becoming a lawmaker. In Parliament, he was largely a backbencher, leaving the party's reins to his mother, Sonia Gandhi. In December 2017, he took over the party's leadership from her after she suffered health problems. And that may have been one of the problems, that he just lost the respect of the populace to such an extent. So that's been the major problem. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. We're fine here. And it's about 11:30, so we'll wish you a great day and a great 4th of July. And, you know, America...
Hey, you a judge.
America sort of. Is, I report on whoops. Cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio, Cabot Cheddar...
Sorry, we weren't going to be playing a commercial, but let me just quickly see if we've got everything in place. I think we do, and I wanted to tell you what we're going to be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday, and I'm just not sure who we have on tomorrow. Oh, yeah, it looks like we're going to be having Victoria Garrity, the mayor of Austin. She'll be on from 10 o'clock in the morning and to 10:30, and then we'll have Richard Cerulli from 10:30 to 11, and that'll be our day. So, my goodness, so enjoy today. It's going to be a very interesting day, and it may be the extravaganza of a lifetime that may return or may just never come back. You never know, but it's a 4th of July celebration. So despite all the histrionics, just enjoy America and recognize its independence and hope for its future. Okay, so there we are. We'll say goodbye and thanks again. Goodbye.